evening, everybody. My name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. And with all the new folks and in memory of my friend Jack, who we lost this year, he would always take his watch off to give the new guys hope that this meeting might come to an end. I'll do the same thing, because without Jack, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. He was one of the many guys in this room that, without our paths intersecting for those few minutes, my life might be a different ballgame. And that's kind of the deal with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about your experience this weekend. I've had 4 or 5 conversations that feel like they just may have shifted my life 1 degree in either direction. And what happens when these guys stand up with 30 and 40 and 50 years of sobriety and your life gets shifted just 1 degree, you end up in a whole different place. And I guess I want to start by saying thank you so much for including me in this weekend, for teaching me and continuing to teach me to be a man. Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where boys get to become men, and I get to learn that from you folks, and you've included me in that. This has been going on, I guess, 30 years without me, and I have no doubt it would keep going without me, but you let me be a part of it this weekend, and that feels really cool to walk shoulder to shoulder with a lot of the men in this room. And all of these new guys, I hope something inside you might be flickering that tells you how special this place is. And I can't imagine getting to pick up a big book and start my journey in an event like this. This is just so cool. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing here that'll hurt you. It's all good all the time, even though it probably feels a little scary when we're shaking and sweating and coming up here. And guess I should also thank Mike Barnes for taking the time to come get me and feed me and make sure that I was fed and watered and had a nice place to sleep. I'm not to the point yet where I take that for granted, that anybody invites me anywhere and treats me like, you know, I'm a human being. And I don't want to forget that, because I'm not here by any virtue. All of those guys that stood up with less than a year sober, my guess is that they invite a guy like me for you. Because on my sobriety date, I was separated from alcohol on August the 30th of 04. I just turned 40 years old. That means I got to you folks just over 30 years old. When I walked through those doors, cusping 30, I've never felt so old. If I live to be 100 years old, I don't think I'll feel as old as I felt at 30 when I walked through those doors. And I felt like there was just too much water under the bridge. You know, I'd kind of screwed up a life before it had even begun. And you don't get to come back from where I just messed up too many things for too long to even get a start at life. They just came out with that new movie, Failure to Launch. You know, that's kind of how I felt about life. It was over before it began. So if you're sitting here thinking that, number one, you're wrong, and that's the good news. From Ocean City, Maryland, is where I got to come to you from. I've had two sponsors there. My first was a gentleman named Jim. Jim had a sponsor named Clarence Snyder, who had a sponsor named Dr. Bob Smith. I tell you that not to, like, impress anybody. It's not that impressive. But just to tell you a little bit about what you're going to hear, I think it's important that we know what we're getting and where it comes from. Sometimes Alcoholics Anonymous, in my limited experience, if you remember the telephone game that we played in, like, second grade, you know, where Al's going to whisper something to Mike, like, his suit is gray. And he's going to whisper it to Tim. He's going to whisper it to Bill. And it's going to go all the way around the room. And by the time it gets to the back, I'm going to say, what's the original message? And the guy in the back is going to say, purple elephants fly at night. I mean, and it's not even going to resemble, you know, the original message. So that's the only reason that I tell you that. What happened, there's a book. With all those folks that stood up, it just really moved me. Before I opened my mouth, I was really powerful tonight. There's a guy named Ernest Kurtz that wrote a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. It's one of my favorite books, and it talks about one of the reasons that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And it's real hard to talk about. What I want to talk about tonight is awakening. If Alcoholics Anonymous was a business, which it's not, but if it was, every business needs a product, right? You know, what type of business are you in? Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be in the awakening business. If we had a product, that would be it. That's the end result of this whole deal and these steps and sponsorship and the meetings and these encouraging conversations that we're all having are all pointing each other and encouraging each other towards this one thing, awakening, and to continue to awaken. And if you're new, that term spiritual awakening might freak you out like it freaked me out. Don't let it. It's quite literally what it sounds like, an awakening of the spirit and nothing more and nothing less. That's substantial. For me, I can remember back, I think it was first grade, second grade, kind of bounding out the door each day to school. And I'd have that little lunchbox. I think for me, it had the Transformers on it or whatever was, you know, the thing for you when you were that age, that little lunchbox. And I'd run out the door and I wonder if it was I was going to have peanut butter and jelly that day or was it going to be tuna fish? I wonder if we were going to play kickball or stickball or tag at recess. You know, and we get out there at recess and in the spring this time of year, you remember recess, man, when that grass area, the fresh cut grass, and you could just smell that fresh cut grass and I wonder if Sally was going to talk to me on the playground. And what game are we going to play? And maybe, you know, you'd lay on your back in that fresh cut grass and look up at the clouds, and it was one of those white puffy cloud days where you'd sit there and maybe it looked like a dinosaur or a truck, you know, and you'd notice what the clouds looked like and the grass smelled like and what game. And I don't know if me painting this picture is familiar to anybody, but I can remember it like it was yesterday. My spirit was awake. Somewhere around first or second grade, each day seemed exciting. I was present to those sights and smells, and I was in that moment. That was awakened. And somewhere along the line, that went away. I think as my ego developed and this thing called me started to form and I started to make up this me, that stuff started to go away. And then the drinking came in, and I stopped noticing the smell of grass and what the clouds looked like and what day it was and being excited about what might be for lunch and who I'm going to get to meet and talk to each day. That just kind of slipped by the wayside of alcoholism. But Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what it's done through you folks, these steps, this book, the whole deal altogether has caused this inward reorganization where I get to stand in front of you tonight, present here in my own skin and with you. And I've been with you all weekend, man. I've been with each of you. And it's been really cool. So if you're new, that's what we're talking about is awakening. And it's an exciting, it's a fun thing, and it's not scary. And this guy, Ernest Kurtz, he talks about this power we talk about in AA. We call it God because it's a short word and it's fast to say that. I used to describe, I'm a surfer from Ocean City. I used to describe in meetings sometimes to my sponsor, you know, well, I know that there's this wind and when the wind blows and the swell comes all the way across the ocean in just the right direction and hits the reef or the sand, the wave breaks in just the right way and the wind has to be coming offshore and, you know, and I know I don't have anything to do with any of this and when I'm going down the face of that wave, I'm not thinking about anything else and it sure has a lot of power to it, you know, in that way and I know I don't have anything to do with this and, you know, so yeah, I could see there seems to be this power and all these elements that have to come together and there's a whole lot going on out there that I don't seem to have anything. Yeah, you know, and he said, Rich, you just use 15 minutes of our meeting. We just say God. It has three letters and it's really fast and we all know what you're talking about. So if I use that word, those three letters, whatever pops in your head, that's what I'm talking about. And it's very hard to talk at this power and to describe it with words. They don't really suffice. They kind of separate us. If I use the wrong word by accident, you know, this half of the room might go, oh, I don't call it that. And the other half might go, oh, I see it different. And so Ernest Kurtz noticed that what makes AA work is we don't talk at the power. We don't talk directly about it. What we do is we share our stories. And in those stories, we see this power at work. So That's my job tonight. You guys were kind enough to share your time and your lives with me this weekend. I'm going to share my journey to this thing called awakening with you guys. Hopefully, your role, as Ernest Kurtz would point out, would be to look for this power, kind of weave through this deal, because I've already confessed to you, I'm not the world's most spiritual guy. I wouldn't refer to myself that way. I don't think of myself as particularly spiritual, but I'm sure acutely aware of this power coming in and through my life, and that's what I hope you guys listen for. Nobody in my family drank. I'm the only person in my family that's ever had a drink of alcohol. I have one little sister. She's 3 years younger. My mother and father never drank. My grandparents, nobody in the whole family. I don't know anything about genetic theories of alcoholism. That might be true. I don't know. My sponsor told me he thinks I'm alcoholic because I drank too much. I've always just gone with that. If you are new and you're trying to figure out whether or not you're alcoholic and, you know, worse yet, you know, why you're alcoholic. I spent some time with that, you know. Why am I alcoholic? Alcoholics, I like to tell this story that we're kind of like a guy whose house is burning to the ground. I mean, the thing is just burning. It's critical, burning to the ground. The fire department's all there. The paramedics, the neighbors are all out in the yard. You guys are all there. They fed the hose from the fire truck all the way through. You guys are holding it. You're in back of me. You're cheering me on. I'm up front. The house is burning to the ground, and you're screaming at me, Rich, shoot the hose. Shoot the hose. And I'm going, well, hold on. We got to figure out how this fire started. I mean, like, what could matter less than how the fire started, you know? We've got everything you need right here to put the fire out. I can promise you that. And my drinking started, and I can tell you that if you're like me and you can remember anything having to do with your first drink, that might be a clue. If you're deciding, I can't tell you anything about my first Coca-Cola, my first glass of milk, my first water. So right away, I know that my relationship to beverage alcohol is a little different than some other things I like to drink. But some of the older guys at this school, I went to this school, I had a 45-minute bus ride each way. The older kids sat in the back, the younger ones in the front. There was like a social hierarchy on this bus based on age. I don't know if they have that in Texas. You go to the back of the bus, you know, you get beat up. I had a kid, his name was Reed. I don't know if the school assigned him to me. Reed's job was to like beat me up every day. And I guess they do that here, you're laughing. And you know, on this particular day, they asked if I wanted to skip last period and do some drinking. I'd never skipped any classes. I'd never done any drinking, but out of my mouth came, you bet. And I wish I knew that I was going to end up in AA someday and at some conference called Man to Man, because that sounds kind of tough. They said, what do you drink? I said, bourbon. I'd never had anything, you know, so I don't know where bourbon came from. And it's a little embarrassing to be here at Man to Man and to tell you we didn't have bourbon. We had peach schnapps. And that's pretty sissy, right? I mean, that's embarrassing to report to this group. But what makes me one of you, I now know, is not what I drank or how often I drank it, and it's not what it did to me, but it's what it does for me that makes me one of you. And what it did for me on that day is the first thing I noticed drinking with these guys is that I was one of them, just like I felt like one of you all this weekend. No better, no worse, just one of the guys. And they were as lucky to be hanging out with me as I was with them. I'd never felt like that. Then I went into the restroom, and at that school it said boys on the door, but that seemed funny to me on that day. I sort of felt like a man, you know. So I go into the boys' room feeling like a man, and there was a girl that rode this bus. Her name was Nikki. I didn't know how to talk to Nikki. I didn't know how to, you know, sit next to Nikki. I didn't know how to ask Nikki out. Nothing, but I mean, Nikki was something else, man. And on this day, I'm in the boys' room feeling like a man, and the next thought that went across my head was that I'm going to sit next to Nikki, you know, automatically with this alcohol in me. All of a sudden, I intuitively know how to handle a situation that's been baffling me. And so now I get on this school bus. I'm going to the back of the bus to sit next to Nikki, where I know darn well I don't belong. Reed gets up out of his seat, you know, to give me my daily beating, and, you know, I put it into Reed with everything my little buddy had. Reed went down, and Reed went out cold in that seat, and the whole school bus got really, really quiet, you know, and I sat down next to Nikki, and this feeling came over me that some of you guys know. I mean, it was like long overdue respect. I mean, I've been looking for this for a long time, and I'm talking to, you know, looking at Nikki, and Nikki's looking at me. I'm looking at Nikki. Nikki's looking at me. We get to our bus stop. She goes to get off the school bus, and she leans over and gives me this little kiss. and it was half on the lips and half on the cheek. Maybe some of y'all remember this. I mean, this was different than my mother and my aunts had ever kissed me. I felt it in my toes. And Nikki got off that school bus, man, and we got to my stop. I went in, and I was in big, big trouble. My parents, who didn't drink, I came from a wonderful house. Morals, values, integrity, no drinking. They knew I was drunk. They left me in the bathroom all night. I don't think I've ever been sicker. Woke up, I was grounded forever. Y'all remember, that's like life without parole when you're 13. You know? And I woke up knowing that, man. You are in big, big, big trouble, and I don't ever remember feeling that sick. And the next thought that went across my mind is, you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You bet. You bet. Grounded forever, sick as a dog. I mean, what a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus. You know? And what I didn't know is what happened right then and there was something inside of me, something happened. Bill describes it better than I can. It set in cycle this thing like a boomerang that was going to one day turn in flight and nearly shred me to ribbons. Just cut me up. And I didn't know that. I don't know that I'd have stopped it if I did know that, because it was doing so much for me and not that much to me at that point. And I would let alcohol do more and more to me in exchange for what it did for me as time progressed. And what happened was, one drink at a time over a series of years, I gave away every little value, integrity, morality, one drink at a time, so slowly that I didn't even know it was happening. Our book talks about that too. It says that often, you know, for an alcoholic like me, it's too late. By the time I realize it's a problem, that I've slipped past that point of human aid, that often the alcoholic's the last to know. You know, I didn't know that was happening. And it turns out that recovery kind of works the same way, doesn't it? Little by slowly, I barely know that it's happening. Just like one drink at a time, I gave away, one meeting at a time, one conversation at a time, one little gem you give me at a time, something comes back and something starts to awaken. And it's a slow process. Problem is, I forget that giving it all away was a slow process. I want it all back right away when I get here, right? That's the big problem with AA. It don't work as fast as the drink. But I sometimes forget that I gave it away real slowly. And my drinking progressed through high school. I got in more and more trouble. My parents would leave me into jail for the weekend. You know, kid trouble, trespassing, drunk in public, urinating in public. I mean, nothing. I don't want y'all to think I'm any type of, you know, tough guy, criminal type. I was an idiot. And my rap sheet should say, you know, drunk and stupid, and then a list of stuff. Turns out that that this God deal, you know, gave me certain things, like the power gave all of us. You know, we're all good at some things, not good at other things. It's just who and what we are. And I have two things that this power gave me. I can remember almost anything I read and where it is on the page. I can't necessarily tell you the page number, but it just stays. That was very good for school. It does not make me smart. Don't confuse that, because I think smart comes from like hard working and studying. This was just sheer something I had nothing to do with. I was also a good athlete, and the two of those together, I ended up getting a scholarship to the University of San Diego, 3,000 miles away from those good parents. I wanted to get out of there. I've been surfing since I've been a little kid. I love being near the ocean. I thought, man, this is going to be great. It turns out it was a Jesuit college. I didn't know what they were, nor did I care. I was on scholarship out there. I fell in with four guys on that soccer team that were also on scholarship. They were from 20 minutes away, a little town called Tijuana, Mexico. And these guys had lots of cousins. Each one of them had like 15, 20 cousins. I'm a good sizer-upper, if that's a word. Most alcoholics are. We're good sizer-uppers. You know, I can figure out the rules of the game no matter where I am. You know, you throw me in inner city Baltimore, I can figure out the rules of the game. You throw me in Texas, you know, it ain't going to be long before I got boots and, you know, a bolo tie, right? And in California, the deal was, it seemed to me, was the guys with the stuff got the babes. I didn't have any stuff. I'm in the dorm. I got no money. I come from a you know, farm family, grew up on a little horse farm, and here I am at this campus that looks like Beverly Hills 90210. There's palm trees. The kids are driving these little red BMW convertibles. They got the girl sitting next to them. It didn't take me long to figure out that, you know, these guys from Mexico knew how to get this green stuff just across the border that these rich kids like to smoke. So I quickly get that going on to put a little money in the pocket so that I could go out and drink more and take the girls out. I also intuitively knew, nobody told me this, no girl ever told me this. Somehow just deep inside I knew that no woman was going to want anything to do with me unless I could take her out first class. It was going to have to be top notch, you know, nice dinners, good car. Nobody ever told me, you know, I don't like you for you. You're not a nice guy. You know, let's just get to know one another. I don't know why I knew. I just somehow thought that. My drinking's getting more and more. My life's getting full. You know, we're very busy people, alcoholics, especially when we're new. You know, I'm unemployed. I'm shaking. I'm sweating. My sponsor says, you want to go? No, I'm busy. You know, like, doing what? You know? My life's getting busy. I got two-a-day soccer practices in the morning with the team, the afternoon. The college ends up getting me this lady, she's called an academic advisor. That sounds pretty neutral, right? Not threatening in any way. Not for me. Another thing about an alcoholic of my variety is I look back. There's been a lot of people in my life that have tried to give me a nudge in the right direction, a little steering, a little help. This lady's job was just to help me pick out the classes that maybe I'd graduate in 4 years. That's it. But I don't see it like that. Anybody in my life that's ever tried to help me, I think you're trying to hurt me. I think you're trying to hold me down. You're trying to tell me how to live my life. Back off. You know, let me do this deal my way. And that's how I saw that lady. She did tell me that I need to get some other stuff on my resume if I wanted to go anywhere in life, that, you know, like soccer and mediocre grades don't get you real far. And they had this idea. She said they'd been bouncing around for a couple years at that university. They wanted to start an office of alcohol and drug education. It was going to be a peer counseling program where they wanted students to counsel other students with alcohol and drug problems so that it didn't come from a teacher or a faculty member or an authority figure. We want to get, you know, a student certified as an alcohol and drug counselor to be the founder of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Education. We want that guy to be you, Rich. You bet. You know. And off they sent me. They get me certified. I could tell anybody in this room more about alcoholism than you care to know about academically. I can tell you all about the Jelinek curve and where we're jumping off and all this kind of nonsense and, you know, the bioprocesses of turning alcohols into simple sugars and, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. While I'm dying of it, I know all about it, right? And I found that there's no chapter in our whole book called, like, Into Knowing, right? Like, that's a strange thing, because a lot of other areas of my life, knowledge gets me somewhere. But with this deal, it didn't seem to be, that wasn't the deal. You know, now my life's really busy because I've got a lot going on. I got these two soccer practices. I got the Jesuit classes. Then I got to come back. I got to shrink wrap a lot of this green stuff to get it in the mail, get it all across the country. Now I got office hours at night from 7 to 10 to counsel you pathetic drunk people. I'm giving you, you know, pamphlets to the AA meetings and schedules. And by the way, if anybody needs a little something to take the edge off, come see me at 10 o'clock afterwards and we'll get you squared away. And now I got to drink a little bit more and more and more to fall asleep at night because I'm busy. And if your life was like my life, you'd need a few drinks to fall asleep too. And a book talks about that often the alcoholic lives a double life. And I could tell you that if I only had two going on, that would have been really good. I wanted to know what, like, the AA, and I'd have told you, and I believed it, that I needed these drinks just to fall asleep, you know? And I mean, shoot, when I got here, those first couple months, you guys that stood up, man, I'm with you guys. I don't know if anybody's going through the wet pillow deal right now, where you got to flip it over a couple times a night, you sweat right through that thing, and I'm not talking the pillowcase, I'm talking the pillow, and you're shaky, you wake up a couple times, you know, it's just nasty, and I wanted to know, like, what's the AA over the counter, you know, what's the AA approved, like, sleeping pill? I mean, how in the world do you guys sleep without drinking? And if you ask some of these older guys that are here, they'll tell you, I said, what do you take to sleep? And they would say weird things that don't seem to answer the question. You know, they say, well, we take the 12 steps because a clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. Huh? Like, what? So I guess that's the answer, you know, that there's, if anybody's new and wondering, there's not an AA-approved over-the-counter sleeping pill. But we do have 12 steps, and it turns out that they were right, and that's kind of also my job. AA is sort of like, it's It's really not a lot different than first grade. It's sort of like show and tell, you know? Alcohol beats me down enough to I go, what do I do, Bob? And Bob tells me what to do. And then you go, okay, now tell him what you did. And then I stand here and go, well, here's what I did. And I kind of report back to you guys on what you told me to do in the first place. And then you all go, oh, that's great. Yeah. And so it's sort of like a big show and tell. So alcohol's beating me up pretty good at this point, you know, and I got all these different things going on. By my senior year, I'd switched from the green stuff to the white stuff. It was more money. I will tell you that halfway through my senior year, I owned my first home. It was 423 Nautilus Street in La Jolla, California. It's the third house up on the right from Wind and Sea Beach. It's one of the most beautiful counties in this country. I was driving a silver BMW convertible. It had a number on the back that let all of you know that no cars, that they don't even make this particular model in the United States. I had to have it shipped here from Europe. It's one of the European. You know, I'm that important. And you could tell that just by looking at the back of the car. I'm dating the most beautiful girl in that college, or at least that's what you guys thought, so I dated her. I still don't know if I liked her. but that's the way I am at that point. And it's about 6 o'clock in the morning. I remember eating some cereal, I think, in my underwear, and boom, 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 every single door in that house came down. The smoke bombs went off, and on came those plastic zip ties. I don't know if any of you guys have had them. They're less comfortable than the handcuffs. And off I went to the first time to the federal penitentiary, the Metropolitan Correction Center in downtown San Diego. I'd never been in a federal penitentiary. I never had anything like this. The San Diego Union Tribune and the Los Angeles Times said, Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. And the federal sentencing guidelines, it turns out that they're these guideline things where they just kind of add up all that little stuff. It counts. They do it like a chart, and it said 45 to 63 years, you know, that I'm looking at for this. And the judge is going to sentence me somewhere in there if I'm found guilty. And I'm thinking, whew. And I'd had lots of what I call near misses. It's another thing about an alcoholic of my variety. I don't respond real well to near misses. We've heard a lot about this weekend, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, these firm talks, the warnings of doctors, things that might get the average guy's attention, but not somebody like me. You know, that's for other people. And I'd done things like roll a CJ7 Jeep. I used to drive one of those, and with no doors, no roof, keg of beer in the back, a bunch of kids from the team, go around a turn a little too sharp in one of those, they roll. And that might get the average guy's attention. You know what I think? We all walk away, we're banged up, busted up. You know what I think? Whew, man, that was some good driving right there. That was like NASCAR stuff. Do you guys see that? I am a good drunk driver. I mean, that was good stuff. Whew, I mean, it just goes right past me. But that particular day in that courtroom, the United States attorney stood up. He said, if Mr. Bruckner is given any bond whatsoever, he's going to flee to Mexico and live a happy and successful life with his business partners. And that guy was a direct hit. That was the first of a series of what I call direct hits. Happy and successful life. I hadn't been happy and successful in Baltimore with my parents in Ocean City, in La Jolla, California. Happy and successful life. And I'm going to go to Tijuana with a bunch of guys looking to kill me and have a happy... What is this guy talking about? I mean, it got my attention. The next thing that happened, I was the only person in that penitentiary that was guilty. There was a couple thousand men. They were all innocent. And they told me that every day. And you hear about it, you know, in the yard and at racket dinner and stuff. And they told stories. And what I now know is that the power that we're talking about, that three-letter word, it surrounded me with enough of me that I was able to see me for the first time. And what these guys would say were things like, well, I'm here because of my mechanic. You know? And if my mechanic had fixed my taillight properly, that cop would have never pulled me over. And if he'd have never pulled me over, he'd have never smelled the alcohol on my breath. And if he'd have never smelled the alcohol on my breath, I wouldn't have been arrested, and they wouldn't have searched the trunk incident to arrest and found all that dope. That's why I'm here. And if I ever get out of here and I find that mechanic, he's in big trouble because he's the reason that I'm in here. You know what? And if I hooked up any of these guys to a lie detector, they'd have passed it. They believed that. And I told story after story after story like that my entire life. And what happened, another direct hit, the beginning of this awakening thing, for the first time in my life, I realized that I was where I was because of who I was, and I was who I was because of how I live. I'm going to say that again because it's a big deal for me. I was where I was because of who I was. I was who I was because of how I live. And you guys are real big on that. Now, yeah, in other words, I'm not going to have a tombstone that says, "Here lies Rich Bruckner, he meant well." I don't know about any of you, but I always meant well. I never once left the house on a Friday night, took that shower, you know, maybe put on that fancy shirt. You said, "What are you doing tonight, Rich?" And I said, "You know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm going to go out tonight and I'm going to break my mother's heart to where she can never look me in the eye again for the next several years. You got any plans tonight, Charlie?" "Yeah." "What are you doing tonight, Rich?" "Tonight I'm going to go out and shame my little sister to the point where she doesn't speak to me for 6.5 years. What are you up to tonight, Bob?" I never once left the house with that. You know, I was just going to have a few drinks, maybe meet a girl. It was going to be one more fun night. You know, just those were my intentions. But nobody cares about that. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I can report to you, certainly none of the men in my life that matter have asked me what I think about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we think about our book. Do you agree with it? Do you like our steps? You think they're properly numbered? You know, you got any new ideas for us? You know, we've only been here 45 years, you know, working this deal. And, you know, what do you think? You know. Matter of fact, my thinking matters very little to you folks. Most of you tell me it's my problem. You know? I used to say things like, "Man, I'm losing my mind." And they'd go, "No, if that was the case, you'd be in great shape." You know? That's the whole goal of AA. You know? But, so anyways, you all seem to care a lot more about what I do than what I think or what I say. And I realize even tonight that we all carry the AA message, and when absolutely necessary, we use our mouth, you know. So tonight's the night I got to do that. But most of the time, you're just watching what I do. I was in there for almost 9 months, and about 2 days before trial, it turns out that the DEA agents had some honesty problems of their own, and they'd lied on the affidavit to get the search warrant. It was a bad search warrant, apparently, which means that all the stuff that they found was not allowed to be used in court. The case was dismissed, and I walked out what they would have called a free man, but you guys know that I was anything but a free man. Anybody that's been in the penitentiary for any period of time, when you get out, you're thirsty. And I couldn't stay where I was, and I couldn't go back home. I'd used up everybody in my life, my mother, my father, my aunt, my sister, anybody that loves and cares about me. That's another thing like a guy like me. The more you love me, the more I suck you dry. I will just bleed you dry. And the people that don't love and care about me, they're done with me long ago. But God bless you if you love me. Because I could just suck. I'm a user, a taker, a loser. You know, but by this point, I'd used all that up. I couldn't stay where I was. I couldn't go home. I start bouncing around the country to, you know, Sun Valley, Idaho, Steamboat, Colorado, Utah. I stay where I am as long as I can. I'm the type of drinker. I eventually get warrants. I don't seem to do anything decent in a blackout. I don't know what that's all about. I'm still waiting for somebody to report back to me that I did something kind. While I was in a, you know, that was really nice. You went to the grocery store last night and were unloading little old ladies' groceries for them. That was never the case, you know. It was always stuff that seemed to be end up in warrants. When I get a warrant, I run, because that's what cowards do, you know. Got men, like, face the music and walk through problems. I'm a runner. I usually move at midnight. I get word of these warrants and I get out while the getting's good at midnight. I get to the next state. I leave half of whatever I had behind. I think if I had all the television sets back that I've left across this country, I'd have a Best Buy store out here. You know, and I eventually end up where all big shot, you know, tough guy, wannabe drug dealers, you know, end up when the federal government, you know, seizes everything, house, bank accounts, cars, when alcoholism just has you lock, stock, and barrel, tells you when you're waking up, when you're sleeping. I end up where all guys like that end up. Back on my mom's couch in Ocean City, Maryland. You know, and if you're giggling or laughing, you know, you might be a mom's couch guy, and it turns out that that's a really good place to start this journey to sobriety, is mom's couch. There's only one rule at mom's couch. I mean, I couldn't even believe she took me back one more time and was going to let me stay. I mean, I was never, ever, ever going to drink again. I meant business. You all know the rule at mom's house, right? You can stay here as long as you want, as long as you got it. As long as you don't drink, we got some mom's couch, guys. Oh, yeah. Well, that lasted about 2.5 weeks. It ended up in a restraining order. I couldn't come 100 yards of my mother, the house. My aunt and uncle had one. I had three goddaughters, their kids. It just got too painful to have a guy like me around. I'm the guy that shows up on Thanksgiving for a hot meal. Silverware may or may not go missing. Each of those little girls gets on my lap and calls me Uncle Rich and says, "Are you going to be here for Christmas, Uncle Rich?" And I say, "You bet, Courtney. What do you want?" And she tells me about the new American Girl doll. And I say, "You bet. Uncle Rich will bring that. How about you, Christy?" And she gets up. "Are you going to be here for Christmas, Uncle Rich?" "You bet." And she tells me, "One more Christmas, I don't show up." Not because I didn't want to. Every fiber of my being wanted to be there. Alcohol did not allow me to be there. I didn't know that. It's one of the differences, I think, between our book uses this word delusion a lot. It doesn't use denial. That word's kind of come in from some other places, I think. And the difference is denial. You know, I take Al's wallet and Al says, "Hey, Rich, you got my wallet?" And I say, "No, I don't." And I'm lying and I know I'm lying. And you hook me up to a lie detector, tell you, go boop, 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 boop. I mean, I'm just lying. And I know it. But delusion's a whole different ballgame, much more serious. Al says, "I take Al's wallet." He says, "You have my wallet?" I say, "No, sir, I don't. You know, let me help you look for that." And you hook me up to that lie detector test. "You have his wallet?" "No, I don't." I believe it. I believe what I'm saying. I mean, that's really a pretty serious form of mental illness. I mean, and that's what I'm up against. That's what I'm dealing with. And this alcoholism and this delusion that it's talking about, I believe what I'm telling you. I started bouncing in and out of the meetings. You know, I'd sent enough of you to the meetings, for gosh sake. You know, back in college, I knew all about AA. For you all. You know, and I start coming to the meetings, and I'm coming to a 7:30 at noon at night, a 7:30 at noon at night. And, you know, if you could stay sober, you know, by sheer volume of meetings, I would be your poster child. That wasn't the case for me. I'd set up chairs. I'd really do anything that you all asked me to do, other than anything having to do with, the book and the steps, which turns out to be Alcoholics Anonymous. If Jim were here and you were to ask him, he would say Alcoholics Anonymous is the name of a book that our fellowship is named after. We're a spiritual program of action with a support fellowship, not the other way around. You know, Rich, you just seem to have it a little backwards, which is kind of the story of my life. I just had it all backwards. But anyways, I'm bopping in and out. There's a spiritual principle called water seeks its own level. I'm drawn to these meetings. There's different types, you know, of meetings in my area. Some of them, you walk in, they got the book up front. That's a dead giveaway to newcomers. If I'd see that, I'd get out of there. I knew what y'all were going to be talking about, and I wasn't down with it. I like the meetings that we call them topic or discussion meetings, where, you know, you talk about things like, "You got a topic for us tonight?" "She left me again." You know, and we all share our sage wisdom on, like, women leaving us, and I leave, you know, like feeling maybe a little more better about these women leaving. But I mean, I don't know anything more about recovery from alcoholism when I got there. Maybe I'm a little sicker. Maybe I'm a little angry. Or maybe now I have some more justified resentments than when I got there. But really, and I'm drawn to that because that's what I am. I mean, it's just that simple. There's a couple. There's this one woman. My God, I hated her. She made me sick, actually, physically. Her name was Janine. Janine back then had about 18 years sober. Wherever Janine went, she had the book in her hand, which I just thought was, I mean, how do you have 18? Haven't you read it yet? I mean, why are you always carrying that thing around? I mean, it's just stupid. And the thing that made me like, I don't know, you guys just had dinner. This might make you do that thing where you throw up a little bit. She didn't call her sponsees. She didn't call them sponsees. She didn't call them pigeons like some of the old guys. She called them duckies. I mean, do you feel it? You know, I mean, God. And she'd come into the meeting, you know, and she's always smiling, and there'd be like six of them trailing in back of her, like the mother duck. And wherever she'd go, they go, and they got their little books. And in my area, at the end of the meeting, we give chips for like 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, going up to a year. And, you know, they'd say, "Does anybody have 30 days?" And one of the duckies would come up and, you know, you get like 30 seconds to talk when you get a 30-day chip. And This is my 30-day chip, and I'm Sasha, I'm alcoholic, and I'm writing my first inventory, and I'm starting to get free. Ah! And she'd run back to her seat, and, you know, does anybody have 60 days? And the next ducky would come up, you know. I have 60 days, and my name's Vanessa, and I've just shared my fifth step, and oh my gosh, it feels so good. Ah! And she'd go back to her seat, and, you know, we'd go through this whole process, and we'd get to the end. You know, does anyone have 24 hours and a desire to stop drinking? And I come up and get like my 200th 24-hour chip, you know, and I'm like watching the duckies get better day in and day out, and I'm like just dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so the end of my drinking, I end up, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Bill talks about it in his story, which is amazing to me, that you know, a guy in 1939, kind of as lame as Bill, you know, war fever ran high. I mean, this is going to be exciting, right? That a guy as lame as Bill, you know, could speak to a guy as hip, slick, and cool as me coming into this deal in 2004. But he's got this line in there that says, when the morning terror and madness were on, I would steal from my wife's slender purse. Boy, I knew what that was all about. When the morning terror and madness were on. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I break into my mother's house, because that's what tough guys do. I'm not breaking into your house. You might hurt me. You know, we do residential burglaries on our mom's house here at the man-to-man conference. And, you know, so here I go. The morning terror and madness are on. I go into mom's house. She sleeps, you know, with the restraining order, the door locked, and her little purse underneath her bed. And that tells you about the previous nature of our relationship. I'm coming across the floor on my stomach doing my best commando crawl. I'm reaching underneath her bed for that purse. And she wakes up and she catches me eyeball to eyeball off the side of that bed. And she says, Rich, take it. Would you just take it? It was another one of those direct hits. Because by this point, a lot of you in this room, my friends, have been swimming with me. I've been stabbed in Panama and one of those deals gone bad. I've been branded on my shoulder by the guys I worked for in Mexico. They kidnapped me, took me down there, put a brand on me so that I would know who owned me and who I worked for. I mean, I had some consequences. You can beat me up, you can lock me up, but don't you give up on me, Mom. Don't give up. That's something different. Direct hit. And I took it, and I stayed drunk for a period of time, made it back to you folks, got to 36 days without a drink. I won't dare use the word sober, but I got 36 days of not drinking. Yeah, I'm sure a couple of you guys that stood up tonight are not drinking. And that's cool, man. That's the first part of AA. I was not drinking, you know. And not drinking and not changing can be real painful. As a matter of fact, at 36 days sober, I had my liver biopsy before that. I was showing fatty spots. I was to not take any Tylenol for a year. He said it would shut down my liver. I just wanted out. I could not take so much. I knew it. I wasn't at 36 days. I could not have so much as one more drink. I knew it. And I couldn't live one more day without a drink. And I couldn't do your steps. They were for nice guys like you that did, you know, minor things. But that fourth step, I'd look at it, and it was suggesting writing stuff down. Guys in my line of work, that's called a paper trail. I just got out of the federal penitentiary. I'm not real interested in going back. I mean, the first rule is you don't write nothing down. You know, the IRS is looking for, I got all kinds of problems. You know, you don't write them down. And I just know that, you know. So I just decide, you know, 36 days out, I do again what cowards do. I decide to take myself out. I take every Tylenol in the closet and everything else. What I'm about to tell you next, I don't have any more explanation for than August 30th, 2004, the day that this God separated me from alcohol, because I didn't quit drinking. I didn't give it up. I didn't put the plug in the jug. I didn't make a decision to join you. It just happened. I have no idea why August 29th of that year I was drunk as a monkey, and August the 30th, I don't have to take a drink all day long. And there's nothing in our book or any other piece of literature that explains that to me. It just happened. So for me to say I quit drinking, I made a decision, I mean, that's arrogant. That implies that I have power, choice, and control over the drink, which would make me not one of you. That's exactly what I can't do. You know. But on this day, I decide to take myself out. I take all these Tylenol, everything else in the medicine cabinet, and I can't explain what happens next. I go out. Apparently what happened was when my body collapsed, I fell into the refrigerator, which smashed into the wall, which was a crappy thin wall in an apartment, you know, where drunks live. And And the lady next door, who had never missed a day of work, was homesick on that Tuesday. She heard the refrigerator thud into the wall, she said. It scared the daylights out of her. It sounded like a car was coming through the wall. She ran outside, looked through my front door. She said she saw feet laying on the kitchen floor. Called 911. The paramedics bust through the door. I wake up back in the same hospital that I'd been in four times in the year prior. I wake up in one of those paper sexy hospital gowns, all kinds of tubes and stuff in me beeping. I couldn't even kill myself right. You know, that's a new low when you can't even take yourself out right. And then as my eyes cleared up and I started to come to, y'all know who's at the end of the bed. Janine with the duckies. And they're all lined up. And I'm not sure if there's a place called Alcoholic Hell or not, but I was pretty sure I was there. And Janine did not talk to me that day. Janine did not say a single word to me. But she did talk to the duckies. She said, "Girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls." And something inside me snapped. That last bit of pride, ego, blinders, walls, whatever we like to say. I don't know what it was, but it was gone. Something snapped. Something broke. And for a while, I was a little bit jealous of Bill. Got the bright light and the wind, right, in that hospital room when he describes it. I mean, that sounds majestic, the bright light and the wind. I got Janine and the duckies, you know, and I thought I somehow got shorted. But I now know that Janine and the duckies were every bit as powerful as that bright light and that wind. Because the next thought that went through my head, I've never had a thought like it before. You've heard what kind of guy I am. I don't listen to anybody about anything. And the next thought that went through my head was, you know what, if you make it out of here this time, I'm going to find one of those old guys with that book on their hand and that smile on their face, and I'm going to do everything they tell me to do. That was it. That was me being surrendered to you. I'm going to do whatever y'all tell me. And boy, that marked the beginning of one hell of a journey so far. That was the greatest day. I didn't know it, but that was to be the greatest day of my life. And I found that man, Jim, and he started taking me, explaining this stuff to me, you know, because it turns out on the very front page of the book, it says this is our basic text. And if you look up textbook in a dictionary, it says a tool used for teaching and learning. And that implies there's going to be a teacher and there's going to be a learner. And guess which one you are, Rich? He said, you know, you think you're pretty smart. You know, you've been to a lot of school. Has anyone ever given you, you know, what do you know about textbooks? Anybody ever handed you an algebra book and said, go home and learn it? Of course not. That's not what you do with a textbook. It takes a teacher and a learner, and they're in a specific order. I didn't pick up on that. You know, that these steps and everything, there's a certain flow, a magic to Alcoholics Anonymous, that when we're just led down this road and I just go where you all take me, it seems to work right nice. You know, he started explaining this first step, and what was wrong with me was that I had less power. He said, would you agree that this powerless thing, you know, less power? Makes sense. Yeah. Less power to do what? He goes, that second part of the step. He goes, is there any decision that you could think of that you've made a couple hundred times in your life and not been able to carry it out? And I said, yeah. That I'm never, ever going to drink again. How have you done managing your own decision to never take another drink? Well, not very well, Jim. Not very well. He says, okay, so you're telling me that you have less power than is required to manage your own decision. I'd never heard it like that, and it made perfect sense to me. And if you heard it different, that's cool, but that made perfect sense to me. And that's what I am. That's what you're looking at. I'm a guy that to this day, the same as that day, I have less power than is required to manage my own decision to never take another drink of alcohol. And that's why I need you, God, the steps, this felt, the whole kit and caboodle. I don't know which one I need on any given day, so I'm hanging with you for all of it. And he told me that I'd already done the second step. It was all for us. 1, 2, and 3 was a conversation. I think it lasted 5, 10 minutes. There wasn't any writing or anything like that. He told me that I'd come to believe in a power greater than myself called Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know I had. He said, why else are you here? I'd ask anybody in this room that. I don't think that there's a place out there, unless I'm wrong about Texas, that court orders you to AA conferences. They might send you to meetings, but not conferences. If you're here, it's because you want to be, and you think that there might be something here. There's some magic in the air, right? Maybe this place can help me. He said, that was a heck of a great place to start. The belief alone that I had come to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could help me. He said, what a wonderful place to start. And if you believe that, wouldn't it make sense, Rich, to make a decision to go ahead and give Alcoholics Anonymous a try? Third step. And I said, well, I've done that many times. It doesn't work for me. I've got 97, 24-hour trip, blah, blah, blah. And he said, hang on, buddy. You really haven't, you know, you shouldn't say that out loud because somebody might believe you. You know, they might hear that and believe that. You've never really tried Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, that's when he laid it on me, is a set of steps, you know, principles, steps, spiritual in nature, that when practiced, never done that, you know, enable the sufferer, that's me, you know, to become happily and usefully whole out there in the world. And that was, I'd never done any of that, and I knew it on the inside. You know, I come to lots of meetings and set up your chairs and your literature, make your coffee and stuff, but I'd never done any of that. He said, you know, do you really think it's fair to say that when you've never even tried it? So I stopped saying that. You know, and I made a decision to go ahead and give Alcoholics Anonymous a try. He told me my third step decision that the only physical evidence of having made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the Alcoholics Anonymous process is a written fourth step. He said, because it's the first act that I've ever taken against my will. Because I've already told you, I didn't want to write anything down. So for me to start writing anything down was against my will. You know, it was a new deal. I was doing something different. I was taking an action I didn't believe in and I didn't want to take and following some suggestions. And we wrote down, went through all that stuff, you know, in that fourth step and looked at it. And we looked at it from a different angle and I became acquainted with, you know, who and what I am and what I do time and time again and how, you know, I have a whole lot of situations, but there's only one guy involved in all of it. There was only one common denominator in each and every part of that, me. The names change on the left, but it all ends up with the same guy on the right, me. You know, and at that point, some stuff was happening. He introduced me to this guy, Roger, and by that point, I'd been through 6 and 7. We had this list, and I was coming up on step 9, and Roger challenged me. He said, kid, all we are in Alcoholics Anonymous up to step 9 is a self-informed asshole. That's all you are. He said, you know, really the whole world could care less that, you know, you have some understanding and peace between you and whatever you think's going on out there in the universe in steps 1, 2, and 3. Pretty much nobody really cares that you've done all this inventory work. You know, nobody really cares that you could tell, if I ask you about your defects and shortcomings, that you could talk to me about it. Nobody cares. Nobody cares that you got an 8-step list. But the 9th step, how free do you want to be, kid? This is where the rubber meets the road. How free do you want to be? He just kept saying that, and that resonated inside of me. He said, the 9th step's where we get to rub the record clean, that maybe, just maybe, a guy like me gets to die with the left side and the right side, you know, being equal. And that would be a heck of a life for somebody like me, if I got to just die with the slate being clean. He said, we got all kinds of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we got everything in here from ground beef to filet mignon. What do you want? Bill Wilson talked about it a lot with Father Ed Dowling. He would, you know, use that phrase, the good is the enemy of the best. What do you want? And you've heard about me. I'm a pig. I want it all. You know, I want everything you got. You know, I don't want to sell myself short. I want to do this deal. And he said, well, the first thing you're going to do is start dating your mother. You know that lady that can't look at you in the eye. What could be lamer? You know, by this point, I got my first little AA job. I'm sweeping the floor in this picture frame shop. This guy, longtime AA member, made hand-carved wooden picture frames. And my job was just to sweep the floor, just to keep the sawdust up. And I think I was making like $6 an hour maybe. And he would list play speaker tapes all day long, man, all day long. And you know, and I just, I call them the old guard of alcoholics, Norm Alpe and Cliff Rhodes. You know, play Cliff again. I liked him because he was a surfer, you know. And he'd go, we listened to Cliff 6 times yesterday. Play him again. You know, and I'm sweeping, listening today, going to the meeting at night. And a little became a lot. That was weird. A little became a lot. That $6 an hour on Friday, there was always a little something left to take mom to dinner. You know, I was starting to send $20 to the IRS that I owed $40-some thousand dollars to. I wasn't sure what $20 was going to do, but he said, that's what we do in AA. I'm an all or nothing kind of guy. You know, I'll send you a check when I got all 47,000. Right? That's when we'll address this. You know, problem is that day will never come for a guy like me. And what happened was, as soon as those $20 checks started going out, those letters and phone calls stopped coming in. Clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. I started being able to sleep a little bit, just with the $20 going out. And there was money to take mom to dinner, put a dollar in your basket. And it's talked about in here where a little becomes a little. You guys know what I'm talking about. I mean, the first thing we get in AA is a pay raise just by not spending all the money the way we used to do, right? And this little bit of money is a lot. And it says that when we focus on the spiritual, that the material always takes care of itself. But when I focus on the material, you know, I'd had it backwards like everything else. When I worry about the money, right? How's your 11th step going, Rich? Well, you know, I got to get these bills paid, and once I get all the bills paid and some money in the bank, I'm going to have a whole lot of time for prayer and meditation. I'm just, you know, I got to get this squared away first, and then I'm going to be all meditation, right? You know, who's got time for that when you got to get all these people paid, you know? So I just had some things backwards, and you all helped point that out to me. Ed, I'm doing that, and I'm dating mom. I'm taking her out to dinner, lunch, wherever she'll go. And I don't know how far down the road it was, but I know one day we're having dinner, and up from her plate of food, my mom caught me eyeball to eyeball. And we were just talking, eye to eye, mother to son. And she was looking at her son in the eye, and there we were. And that was the result of little things like, can you come take the trash out? My mom's small. She actually just 2 days ago, she celebrated her 72nd birthday. I got to take her out to dinner Wednesday night. We still date. And she knew I was coming here to be with you guys, and she thought there was no place I could better be, you know, on her birthday than with you all, because if she was here, she'd stand here, and all she'd probably say is, thanks for giving me my son. Because what used to happen was she'd say she can't get up on a chair and change a light bulb. There's three light bulbs and a light fixture above her kitchen. And when that would burn out, she couldn't see in the kitchen to cook. She lives by herself. And that, I'm embarrassed, you know, but it's true. She would say, can you come change the lights? And it would take me a week or two to sober up enough to make the 2-mile trip to my mother's house to change the light bulb so she didn't have to cook and eat in the dark. That's, you know, that's your speaker. That's what I am. And thanks to you guys, you know, you taught me how to show up and change the light bulb. That doesn't sound miraculous, but it does. You know, can you take out the trash? Little things, you know, chop wood, carry water. That's what being a son was just all about, chop wood, carry water. And little by little, this friendship started to form. And my mother and I today, my wife and I just bought a house about a half a mile down the road from my mother. She's one of my best friends in the world. She loves you folks. She loves to make cookies or brownies for the home group. About once a month, you know, comes to the group, says hi, comes to my anniversaries, likes to drop off those cookies just to say thank you. And she knows who you all are, because at the end of my amends to my mother, one of the things, she wanted to know who my friends were, who I dated. She said, I've never felt like I've been a part of your life. And so now she is. And the last thing I want to say about that, in case there's anybody in here that's like me, my whole life I tried to portray that I was something I wasn't. You know, that I was some kind of tough guy, gangster, tough guy. And I wanted to be a man. That's why I loved this conference. I loved the name of it. I wanted to be a man. And it turns out for me that it's awful hard to be a man if you don't first learn how to be a son. And I just had that backwards. Next was my little sister. She hadn't spoke to me for 6.5 years. For some reason, I had a set of Raven season tickets. He said, send them to your sister. She lives in Baltimore. You're 3 hours away. I said, that sounds stupid. These are expensive. And he said, I didn't ask you. I'm telling you, send them to your sister. And I sent them, and nothing happened. He said, send the next set of tickets. I said, didn't you hear me? Nothing happened. Send them. I sent the next set of tickets, and I'm here to tell you, I don't know what was going on. I don't know who they were playing. I don't know what quarter it was. The phone rang. On the other end of that phone was that little sister's voice going, Richie, did you just see that? They threw the ball. They tied it up. The Ravens are tied. And she's all excited. And I have no idea what's going on. All I know, man, is I was talking to my little sister for the first time in 6.5 years. And I kept sending those tickets, and we started to develop this little friendship around football. You know, something that I found that I care very little about in sobriety. But she really enjoyed those tickets. You know, my sponsor pointed out, he said, you know what you like, Rich? You like going to the parking lot early, being the tailgate guy with the nicest prime rib, slicing it in a nice bar. You know, big shot in the parking lot. He said, by the time the game starts, you were so drunk you didn't know who won. He was right. And she really enjoys those games and the ticket. We started to build this friendship, and I go there and helped her with the floor in her house and painting the walls. She bought her first little house and brother stuff, you know. And I'd gotten this promotion at that point in AA, my second AA job. I was vacuuming swimming pools, which just awesome, man. You've got to do that early. You get up at like 5 a.m. I was making $500 a week cash. I couldn't even believe it. And, I mean, that was just – I thought that was all the money in the world. And the sun would be coming up and hit me on the shoulders. I was starting to get back to that feeling I was trying to describe to you guys about second grade. It'd be about 6 a.m. The sun's coming up over the Atlantic Ocean. I'd have my shirt off. I'm in front of a hotel, vacuuming sand out of a swimming pool, looking at the ocean and the sun coming up, maybe some dolphins going past, and that sun hitting me on the shoulders, you know, the early morning sun on your shoulder. I remembered that. Man, it felt good. Something was starting to happen. And, you know, I'm going to these meetings, and something was starting to change because the meetings I used to hate, you know, the ones with the book and stuff, I was starting to like them. You know, the people in AA that really bothered me, I was starting to like them. The other people I liked, I was starting to not be so attracted. Something was starting to shift inside where, you know, what I was attracted to started to change. What I enjoyed about AA started to change. I was coming to life, you know, with you guys, and I'm sending this money. It took about... 2.5 years. Roger is, he's 74. He has congestive heart failure. He's got a pacemaker. He's about this big, but about this big to me. And when I got that last payment off to the IRS, we went to the post office in Ocean City, Maryland. The mailbox is out front, and I put that last check in, and he made me say out loud to the mailbox, my amends to the IRS is complete. And he said, put it in. And I put it in. And this little guy came up over top of that mailbox like Michael Jordan, and we had this high five, and it was one of the greatest days of my life. And the next year went by, and I'll tell you, I got this thing from the IRS, and I opened it up, and it was this letter type thing, and I had a check, and it was a pretty good-sized check. And I drive, he lives about 30 minutes away. I drove over there. I was all upset. I said, you know, they've screwed something up. I'm in trouble. I got this thing. He said, no, dummy, that's called a tax return. That happens every year to normal people. So I get those each year, it turns out. It's pretty good. So the silent deal that I had with the IRS was, you know, I don't ask for anything from you all. You don't ask for anything from me. You know, we'll just coexist. They didn't see it that way, you know. They want that tax stuff whether I, you know, think I'm getting anything or not. And so I've just been paying my taxes, and I get these checks each year, and that might not sound anything. I think it's pretty cool when it happens each year. So with that little sister, what happens? I get a phone call after some time goes by, and we're developing this friendship and getting close and being brother and sister, and that's special to me. On the other end of the phone one day is this guy who I knew, and he says, hey, Rich, this is Justin. I got to ask you something. I know your father's not a part of your lives anymore, and you're a big, big part of your little sister's life. I was calling to ask you if I could have her hand in marriage. I'll tell you what, is I've never felt less qualified for anything in my life. I've told you, you know, I was in the world of piece of crap brothers. I'm right up there. You know, who am I to ask a question like that? But, of course, with my, me being me, I had to say, you do any drinking? And mess with them a little bit. He assured me he didn't. He just wanted to love her, so it sounded like a good job, you know, for him to me that he's just going to love my little sister. And she called the next day and said, would you be doing me the honor of walking me down the aisle? I got to show up a sober man, dressed the way y'all taught me to dress, and her in my arm, and walk my little sister down the aisle and give her away. And that was just dynamite for me, just dynamite. And the book says that these great events will come to pass, you know, for you, for countless others. It's just what happens. She's a big part of my life today, and her career's gone great, and she's just my little buddy. Now I'm her big brother. Again, that's one of the things that I've lost. In the natural order, there's something special about being, I'd sort of surrendered to alcohol, my role as big brother. You know, the guy that little girl looked up to, that went away. And it's back. And next on that list, you know, he said next is Ethan. And Ethan was my childhood friend. We grew up since that big, and Ethan asked me to be the best man in his wedding when I was living out in La Jolla, taking over the world, you know, being a big shot. And his father sent me a plane ticket and got me fitted for a tuxedo, bought the tuxedo. I'm to be the best man. I was too drunk to get on the airplane. I didn't call and I didn't show up. And I don't know about you guys, but when I do something like that, you go on a secret list of people that I can no longer face because I don't call and say I'm sorry. I don't face, I've already told, I'm a coward. And I keep a secret list. You might have one. You'll know if you have one because if you got to look at, you know, that caller ID thing, newcomers often, they don't have a house, a car, a driver's license, but they got caller ID, right? You got to look and your eyes get all big whether or not you can answer that phone call or not. That's called living in bondage of self. And I had that for a long time with a whole lot of people for a whole lot of reasons where I could not answer the phone. And most of you that are my friends will tell you that if you call me today, I answer the phone, hello, Rich Bruckner. That is an incredible freedom. Doesn't matter who's on the other end of that phone. Nobody's looking for me for anything. You know, hello, Rich Bruckner. And anytime Ethan would call after that, my guts would get tired, get that little sick feeling. And, you know, I knew why he was calling to tell me what a bum I was. I'd heard about how great his wife was. I heard he had a little boy, a little girl, and they were wonderful. And I'd hear, you know, you hear the reports. And every time you hear it, it gets worse and worse and worse. And so, anyways, I asked if I could come down there and have 10 minutes of his time. I explained to him I was in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to do my best to clear up the wreckage of my past so that I don't ever have to take another drink of alcohol. And I knew that there was no excuse for my behavior at the wedding. Maybe his father could be there when I come talk to him. And he said, sure, Rich, you could be here. He lives about 4 hours away. He said, you could be here Saturday morning at 8 a.m. if you can make it. And this was about 10 years later, so he remembered. And I showed up, and I had a pocket full of money, and his parents' car was in the driveway. I knocked on the door. Ethan opened the door. His wife was by the kitchen island. Little girl was holding onto her hand. His mother and father were in the back, and some little boy came darting out. I don't know where. All I know is he came running for me, man, like a freight train. He grabbed a hold of my leg like a tree trunk. He looked up at me in my eyes, and he said, you're my Uncle Rich. Daddy said one day I'd meet you. And our book says that 9 out of 10 times the unexpected happens when the approach is made in this fashion. And right then and there, in that instant, it wasn't a learning, it wasn't a knowledge thing. Somewhere from the inside out, I knew that it was me all along. Those scales of pride and prejudice that Bill taught that just dropped, I understood that I was what had separated me. He was 5 years old. I missed 5 years of this kid's life that had been waiting to meet Uncle Rich because of my own ego, my own stupid pride, my inability to face the music, my inability to say the words that I was wrong. I am what separates me from you, and if I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. There isn't any difference. And in that instant, I knew that. It was just, I can't explain it any better. With that kid grabbing my leg, I knew that I was the problem. I keep me from you. Last, I had this, I'll tell you the rest of that. As I do show up now each year, it wasn't that one event. I show up at those kids' birthdays. I drive the 4 hours. If it snows, I take them sleigh riding. At Christmas, I do my family, and then I do his with presents. And you know those little kids, you know what they say, you know how kids are. They go, Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days. Like it's an accident. I just drove 8 hours. But, you know, that's what AA lets me do, is show up on all the good days. And I made my amends to his father in the other room. I said, I think, I went through all this, and I know I owe you some money. He said, you're right, you do, $1,372. And I didn't see that coming either. I reached in my pocket. I had it from the swimming pools. And I went to take out the money, and he said, whoa, 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 if you're really in this AA thing, you really have a home group and all that stuff, the way that you're going to pay me back is no more than $10 at a time. You're going to take cookies or donuts to your home group. You're going to save the receipt. Don't ever spend more than $10 at one time. Put gas in a newcomer's car that's having trouble getting affording to get to the next meeting. Don't give them the money for the gas. Put the gas in the car, right? Save the receipt. When you have $1,372, the $10 receipts, you bring them to me, and on that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, I'm 28 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been praying for the two of you since you've been that big. It takes a while to pay that back, 10 bucks at a time, you know, but it's not. So that ended up, didn't see it coming. And the last thing I had was I had an old warrant out in San Diego because I told you what happens when there's a warrant, I run. a judge had ordered me. He gave me a phenomenal sentence. I got pulled over for a DUI. I had some outside issues in my pocket. They carried 5 years. He said that it was called the First Time Offenders Program in California. I know there's a couple California guys here. The PC 1000, First Time Offenders Program. You have to jump through some phenomenal hoops, and in exchange, you don't have a conviction on your record. Those extreme measures that that judge asked me to go through was to go to 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said what I say to all judges, you bet, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you tell me, and if you hook me up to a lie detector, I believe that I'm going to do that. I just didn't know that my alcoholism was not going to allow me to do that, and I didn't. And it turned into a warrant, and we've already heard this weekend that the solution, my solutions are worse than the problems. You know, I run and turn a very simple problem into a big deal, and the book says that they pile up and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's what was going on. Roger said, hey, this is a great time to go do that 5 years in California. I didn't think so. You know, I had the swimming pool business going on. Sponsors see things different. It's good to have a sponsor because they just see stuff different. I by that point, I had this woman I was dating in AA. She was 18 years sober. We were, you know, playing house together. I had this business, my relationship, my mother, my sister's all good. And he goes, no, this is a good time. He says, I think you see this wrong. This career that you think you have, you vacuum swimming pools. Somebody will be able to do that. This house that you think you have, you two live in a trailer and you don't own it, you rent it. You know, she's got a God and a sponsor of her own. She's sober 18 years. She was just fine long before your sorry tale came along. You know, and as for your mother, all she's ever wanted you to do is the right thing. Why don't you ask her what she'd like you to do? And he was right about that. I talked to my mother and she said, get it right. And I flew out there to California with a bunch of you all, took me to the airport, you cheered me on. What I didn't know is that you'd written 47 letters to the judge, and when I got there, your letters preceded my arrival. And the judge said, whatever you've done, and you've flown this far on your nickel, whatever you're doing back there in Alcoholics Anonymous, get lost. Get back there to Maryland. You keep doing whatever you're doing. And I can tell you, as I stand here today, I have 36 arrests on my NCIC background report. I've never gotten a break. I'm not a guy that gets a break. And on that day, I did. And my God got bigger. Bill says, at long last, I saw, I felt, I believe. I think that order is significant, at least it is to me, because I saw it happen here. I started to feel it. And then I took these actions, and it became my experience. You guys didn't sell me your God. You didn't teach me about it. You gave me a program of action that allowed me to experience my own. And that's what I have so far, is a God of experience. And I stepped out in the hallway of that court, and I called Roger. I said, Roger, I'm coming home. I'm coming home. They're not locking me up. Tell the guys from the men's group, I'm coming home. I'm not doing the 5 years. He said, whoa, hotshot. What about that college that kicked you out, those Jesuits? Aren't they out there? Why don't you go talk to them while you're there? You can't come home until tomorrow. I'm thinking, man, give me a break, you know? But that seemed like small potatoes. I went over there. Sure enough, the same president was still at that university. And I sat down. I made my amends. I said, I know what the Jesuits are. You guys stand for building men of integrity, education, honor, a whole bunch of things I didn't. I brought shame to this institution. I have no idea how to make it right, but if you tell me, I'll do it. And that president took me to another building, put a stack of papers in front of me and said, fill this out. This is an application to our law school. You're going to go to law school here. You're going to graduate. And you're going to make us proud. That's how you're going to make this right. I thought, this dude's lost her mind. You know, I called Roger. I said, I got 36 arrests. You know, even if I go to law school, they'll never let me take the bar exam. If I pass the bar, the ethics committee will never let me practice law. You know, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. He said, whoa. Did you just tell that president that you'd do whatever they said to make it right? And I said, yes, I did. He said, shut up and fill out the papers. I did. 3 years later, I graduated second from the top of that class, not because I'm smart. You all taught me the AA way to do things. I was 15 minutes early for every class. I shook the teacher's hand every day until they knew my name. I stayed after class, just like a meeting. I asked a question, whether I had one or not, just like we would of the new guy. I did it the AA way and got AA results. I came out of there, and the next thing you know, the phone rings. Some guy's on the other end of the phone. He introduces himself. He says, I'm the state's attorney for the state of Maryland. I know what state's attorneys are. Those are the guys that locked me up. They've done it 36 times. I don't like state's attorneys. He said, I was given your name by somebody that we just received a large federal grant. I want to hire an assistant state's attorney for the state of Maryland to head up the gang and narcotics prosecution unit, I was given your name that you might know something about the importation of narcotics into our country. I'm thinking to myself, the old-timers never lied to me. This is the part of the book they talked about. They said your sordid past will become your greatest asset. They said it. They've never lied to me. They have never lied to me. And I'll tell you, from that day to this, you know, that's what I've done. I've served the state of Maryland for 5 years as the assistant state's attorney. Turns out I'm pretty good. I was hard at first. The judge would say tricky things each morning, you know, like, will the defendant please rise? And I'd stand up, and everybody'd laugh, and I'd turn red, and the judge would say, sit down, and I'd sit back down. And it takes a while to get used to being on the other side of things, you know. And it turns out that what's happened is all that separation that I've caused in my life, you all brought back together through this power. There's not a thing called my home life with my wife. There's not a thing called my work life. There's not a thing called my A life. All those people could be in the same room at the same time, and they are. If anybody was at my wedding a year ago, you'd have seen it. We had the AA guys with the tattoos and the hoops standing next to judges and lawyers and sponsees, and I mean, it was incredible. And we were all having a heck of a time. And each day, you know, I look across and I think that I'm being used in a way of service in just another area of my life that I guess we call it work. But it's not for me because I enjoy it. And if you enjoy what you do, it's not work. It's just another place to be a service. Some people see an armed robber. I see a guy that needed a drink that the morning terror and madness were on. And I've come up with some pretty creative sentencing arrangements in the last 5 years for some of these guys. And I see an awful lot of them at meetings now. I get to have some talks with them that maybe somebody else in my position might not have with them. You know, some people see a criminal, I see a drunk. And I will tell you that every day of my life, I get to say two just incredible things for a guy like me to say. Every morning I stand up, I look at that judge and I say, good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And each night I get to come somewhere like this and I get to say that my name's Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for my life. That's all I got.